Welcome to the Jacob's Well podcast. These messages are intended to feed you some great stuff that you can really dig your teeth into all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime, along with other great resources and ways to keep the conversation going at jacobs-well.net/leftovers. Enjoy the message.
Good morning, Jacob's Well. I'm Greg Meyer. And
I'm Paul Rosenwinkel.
I knew you looked familiar.
Yeah.
So we do have a week of some storytelling today that we are and have been working on for towards quite a while, and that's a trend that's not going to end, but this is really a special focus. So I invite you to enjoy that today, and you turn your Sunday papers over, you will find an outline with a place to follow along and to make some notes about the stories you're hearing today. But, you know, I think the question just sits out there, like, why storytelling?
Yeah, I think one of the most fascinating things that we've discovered is that telling stories helps us to actually understand each other. When we shout data at each other or when we try and argue with each other, we don't really get very far. But when we tell each other stories, we actually are able to listen to one another.
Right. So if we're talking about divided we fall, how do we not go down that road to being that divided? And I think ultimately it comes down to actually knowing each other's stories, to be known and to know and be known. And so to kind of practice here where it's easy, so we can do it, at least relatively easy, so we can do it out in the world where it's really pretty hard sometimes to be known that way and to be actually willing to know other people. We thought we'd be doing that here. And 20 to 30 people said they were willing to tell a story last week, and then I think 11 people told them here, and then a bunch of in the middle school, high school group. So about 20 people told stories last week into groups of us. And I think there's a picture of at least a bunch of them here from the, that were in our groups here from the Commons. It's fantastic. And just every story was amazing and needs to be heard by more people. But we've invited 4 people to share the stories today.
Yeah, and we're hoping to do more storytelling in the future. We found this to be really valuable. And look around end of January, and we'll be hopefully doing an event.
Yeah, kind of an evening story slam sort of thing for lots of people. So something to bring your friends to as well.
Yeah. And so one of the things we're going to be doing as a storyteller comes up is we're going to be handing them one of these ropes. And for you that aren't really familiar, we talk about rope being 3 things: yourself, your community, and God. And one of the things we try and do at Jacob's Well is weave all of these together. I can't braid very well, so I'm not going to do it for you here. But when you are weaving those things together, weaving is good. But also, when you're able to tell your story, when you come to a momentous occasion, that's kind of a knot in your rope, where all 3 of those things are connected really strongly. So that's the symbolism that's behind these.
That knot is something you can hold on to. You're not going to forget that. You can see that knot and then say, I remember that time. And you can tell that story again and share it. And I think anybody who told a story last week, did that feel like a knot moment for you? Yeah, sure. I think so. So we'll be doing that.
There's one more thing. So some people will be sharing pretty emotional stories. And as some of you who shared stories know, that can be a really vulnerable moment. And so if you see someone starting to struggle a little bit or they're starting to maybe get a little emotional, something that you can do to just show support is just snap. Let's all practice that now. Just get your fingers together and do a little snapping. So if you hear me start to struggle a little bit or start to get a little emotional, maybe you could start snapping for me or for anyone else that's...
And if I can't, if I'm not a good snapper...
You can just do a golf clap, just like a light.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. So with no more ado, we'd like to invite Scott Schluter. Come on down. And Scott's going to be sharing a story with us. And to help all of us, so it's storytelling and story listening. And it seems like you guys have it easy and he's got the hard job here. But really, actually listening from his perspective, not yours, is something that is hard for you too. And it's a skill that we all need to learn. And that's why we're practicing that today. So just to get ready for that, let's just take a few breaths. So shake out those shoulders, maybe get your feet planted on the floor. You can close your eyes, leave them open. Have your hands be comfortable. And let's take a nice, long, slow breath through your nose. Let the spirit fill you. Let the moment be quiet. And exhale through your mouth. Just let go of the baggage, let go of the questions, anxieties. One more time, let's take a breath. And let it out. Okay, Scott, they're all yours.
Hello. So my story kind of goes with, you know, people that live in Minneapolis believe that we appreciate diversity. We appreciate cultures. We appreciate colors of the rainbow. But in reality, the colors that many choose to accept are about outside colors and not about inside colors. And in my experience, that's especially true about the inside colors of the political colors of red and blue. So I'd like to tell a story. And several years ago, we were having an election. And I've been living in Minneapolis for several years. And this was no different than other elections. There were political yard signs were scattered throughout the block, throughout the neighborhoods, throughout the city. And the funny thing to me was that they were all the same signs, or all the same party, all the same candidate. And I thought, well, what's the purpose of having yard signs if not to stir thought, if not to create discussion, if not to show value or give direction? What was the purpose if all the signs are the same throughout, you know, and everyone in your block and everyone in your neighborhood, everyone in your city felt the same way? So I thought, you know, I'll put up a different yard sign, a different candidate, a different party. And you probably know how this goes. My elderly neighbor came out of her house. She saw the sign and ran right into a pretty heated discussion, although discussions I thought were supposed to go two ways, and this was definitely one-sided. And you should know my neighbor. She doted on my daughters. She would watch them from time to time. She thought of me as a good neighbor. I mean, we would take care of her sidewalks and shoveling and driveways, and she thought of me as a good dad. But in this situation, she just railed on me as to, how could I ever live in Minneapolis? Why would I want to live in Minneapolis? And how could I believe any of these things that she assumed that I must believe? And I tried to explain to her that I like living in Minneapolis. I love the parks, I love the sidewalks, I like the old homes, I like the restaurants and businesses I can walk to. I think there's a lot of Minneapolis that fits my values. I don't want to live in the suburbs, I like the variety of Minneapolis. But it didn't go anywhere, and she left angry and not comfortable. A little later, a friend of ours stopped by. We shared carpooling duties with our kids going to school. She saw the sign, and it was amazing. That was like virtually the same exact conversation or discussion, just one way. How could I live here? Why would I want to live here? How could I believe any of these things that she assumes I believe? And it didn't. I tried the discussion again with her, and it didn't go anywhere. And I thought it's kind of funny as I was walking back into my house about the irony of the situation that they said that my beliefs aren't appreciating others, yet I was trying to learn, which is, I think, is just a lot more fun to learn than not learn. They said that my values aren't welcome in Minneapolis, and I see so many of the things that I value that are part of Minneapolis. They said that my views aren't accepting of others' views, yet I accept them as my friends, I accept them as my neighbors, and they're the ones who are not accepting me. So even though we look the same, our houses look the same, we care for our kids the same, we go to the same school or the same church, I know that these people would never openly bash on someone in the same way they would on someone who is a different race or a different religion or a different culture, like they would so openly bash on a political view right in my front yard. Now, I also meet with a great group of people every week, and they're very welcoming. They're very open with questions. They're always looking for a better question. And what happens often, especially the last few months, there'll be a speaker, and the speaker might say something like, "We're not going to talk about politics." Of course, you know they're going to when they say that. But do you remember the election night when we started feeling sick about how things were going? Another speaker said, like, "Do you remember the last election night and we started feeling appalled about how things were transpiring that night?" And I'm thinking, I want to raise my hand. I want to have a discussion. But it's just a one-way discussion. This is not two-sided. I mean, I kind of know how it would have gone anyway. But, you know, I want to have a discussion. Also, this last election, I was reading about some of the mayoral and park board candidates. And some of them said that they wanted to see elected officials that looked like them. And I wonder about this when I was leaving my polling place, and there was a woman leaving in front of me who was a different color than I am. And I wondered if she would rather vote for someone who looked like her on the outside or looked like her values on the inside. And that's my story, is that I want to stay curious. I want to keep asking questions. I want to be part of the discussion, and I don't want to be ridiculed for who I am. And that's when I think about Minneapolis, being accepting of colors and diversity on the outside, I wish they would be thinking about being accepting of color and diversity on the inside. And so when you're all sitting at the Thanksgiving table with family or friends, and you might be the lone liberal at a table of red, or you might be the lone conservative at a table of blue, I'd like you to think about what would happen if Minnesota's 45% of red and 46% of blue, what would happen if those colors were mixed together? What would happen if those colors came together? What would you get? You get purple. And I want you to think about that. I will be cheering for purple on Thanksgiving in more ways than one to all come together, and I hope you guys are too. Thank you.
So we were talking about storytelling, and one of the questions that comes up is storytelling enough? Like, is it enough to just talk to each other?
Yeah, it doesn't seem, doesn't have a lot of teeth, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't seem forceful.
Yeah, right. You know, and I don't think there's one answer to this. I've questioned that, and I've heard conversation with our community and within the staff about, like, is storytelling enough? Just doesn't seem to be, you know, like I said, not enough teeth, not tough enough and stuff like that, but... And I don't think there's one answer to it. I mean, there's a place for acting, and there's a place for telling stories and listening to stories. And, you know, I remember not too long ago, this is a couple years ago, I was driving down Portland Avenue, and there's a four-car crash just ahead of me. And so I'm, like, the first car to stop. I pull over, and, like, I didn't go to the first car and say, tell me the story of what happened. You know, I ran around to every car really fast just to make sure there weren't any major injuries that I needed to do something about right then and there. Very fortunately, there wasn't. Everybody was shaken, but everybody was okay. But, you know, so there was a time after that, people really did need to, like, one, we had to kind of figure out what happened for some, you know, legal perspective, but people just needed to unpack what had happened to them and debrief and kind of even check with themselves, in with themselves more to know if they had been hurt. You know, nothing real obvious, but there was some other injuries. Yeah. So there is a place where action maybe sometimes needs to precede, but I think we get carried away with that.
Yeah, I would say we overestimate the power of acting. This is on your Sunday paper. You can fill it out if that feels good to you. I think we overestimate the power of acting, and I think we underestimate the power of listening.
Right.
We tend to be a very action-oriented society and think like, all right, I got to get results on this. And listening doesn't sound like you're getting results.
Yeah, you know, and so those cases like when someone is actually, there's someone being harmed, I think, yes, it's time to do something. When someone's civil rights are being violated, it's time to do something. But the thing is, we think when we just do something, when we apply the fix to that incident, that somehow we've solved the problem, and we haven't. We've done what we have to do right now, but do we want to stop that kind of harm, that kind of those abuses from happening? That means we need to back off, and we really need to start listening. We need to start telling the stories. We need to start listening to one another's stories to get back to where are these things coming from? Where is this hurt? Where are these misunderstandings coming from? So we can start dealing with the root issues behind them.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things we were talking about, fast is slow and slow is fast, that idea is if you rush through and try and fix everything right away, you're going to spend a lot of time trying to fix things on the back end. But if you listen, if you do it slowly the first time, if you really listen to someone, then you can actually hear their story, and you don't have to argue back and forth about views that they think they have when they don't actually have those views.
Yeah, and as a person, I'm kind of wired to get in there, you know, and to fix things. It's sometimes hard to trust the power of story and take the time, because listening to someone's story very seldom just gives that quick delivery of the result you want. But I think we have to play the long game. I think we have to give it time. I think we have to be persistent. And it's not like, oh, I listen and then I wait. No, we listen and we listen and we listen. And we share our stories and we share our stories and we share our stories. And we believe in that process and work with that.
Yeah. So as a part of that, we just want to welcome up Tommy Stark. Tommy is a 7th grader. And before he gets up and starts talking, we just want to take those two breaths again. Yeah, come on down.
Come on down, Tommy.
So we'll just do that big in and then out. And then just another big inhale and out. All right.
Tommy, thank you. And there's your rope, and it's all yours.
So this was a story that happened about 3 years ago. when we went to a vacation on Florida, to Florida. And we decided to go to this national park called Crystal Springs. And the whole point of it was to kind of, I guess, see what nature was like a lot. And I remember sitting down and we had lunch under this building. So after lunch, we decided to go check it out a little while. We walked around, we saw the Crystal Springs. It was very outstanding. It was a very clean, I guess, what would you call it, stream, I guess. It was about 6 feet deep, and you could see the bottom, like, looking through a window. So we went around and checked out some more stuff. Then we ended up coming back, and me and my brothers wanted to go swimming. And so, of course, we bought our swimsuits, and we're wearing them. So they went in the water and found it was too cold. And also, people said there was alligators in there, so they decided not to go, which was kind of scary, but... We're looking around, and I see this manatee under the water. And so it's about 6 feet long, which is gigantic, and about 3 feet wide. And a lot of people said it was only a baby, which was really surprising. So I wanted to go swimming with it, but I didn't know if I should. And you weren't supposed to swim in there, but it was kind of ironic because there was steps leading down into it, but it said no swimming, so that I found really ironic. I ended up jumping in there after a while, and it was cold, but enough where you could get used to it after a while. And I look around, and this manatee is just sitting there in the water looking at me, which I was really surprised by. I was assuming it would swim away as soon as I jumped in. But it came up a little closer to me and kind of snuggled up against my hand, which surprised me a lot. And then it ended up snuggling up against my body. At that point, I really think I felt a connection between me and the manatee, I guess. And it almost reminded me of a puppy, like something playful, like a cat or something. But so we ended up swimming around together, and it was a really fun time. And after that, I had to get out after a while, and it really made me think about water pollution and how a lot of people don't really think about what we do to the water, and that once you really get that connection, it almost makes you realize about what people do to the water, and that I really think people need to pay more attention to it and how people pollute the water, because it's really important, and a lot of people don't get connections like I did. And so that's my story.
All right. Thanks, Tommy. We're going to welcome up Laureen right now. And as she's coming up, let's just do those two breaths in. So just a big in. And out, and then an in, and an out. All right.
I shared last week that I speak about our adoption story in high schools and some middle schools, but I tell kind of the nuts and bolts of our process. And this story relates to our adoption story, but it's not the same one that I tell in high schools. So my journey to motherhood was a pretty rocky one that involved a lot of years of infertility and a lot of failed infertility treatments, a pregnancy loss, reams of paperwork, and three adoptions that fell through before we eventually brought home Isaiah. As a three-day-old infant in September of 2010. And so as my first Mother's Day as a mom approached in May of 2011, people thought that I would just be filled with pure joy. But really, I was feeling deep sorrow and grief for Isaiah's birth mother, Laura. So this is a story about some of the moments surrounding that first Mother's Day. Every year we send a Mother's Day card to Laura. And so I remember that first Mother's Day being in a drugstore or Target and looking through Mother's Day cards, trying to find one that seemed appropriate. Happy Mother's Day is not appropriate to someone who is experiencing Mother's Day without her child. So I think we probably landed on a card that said, "You're special and we're thinking about you." That's kind of the tone of what we send to her on Mother's Day. So that was one moment, probably 2 weeks before Mother's Day. I think the week before Mother's Day, my sister sent me an email full of excitement. My sister is just like a person who experiences pure joy. And she was wondering what we were planning to do for Mother's Day. And I responded probably too brashly about the grief and the sorrow that I was feeling. On the Thursday before Mother's Day, I went to a support group that Willie and I had been a part of for about 3 years, and it included birth parents and adoptive parents and adult adoptees. And this group of people had been with us through all the ups and downs of our journey. And it was a place where there was always understanding, no matter what you were feeling related to your adoption journey. And I remember at that particular night that there were birth mothers there and adoptive mothers who were both sharing all that was bubbling up for them as Mother's Day approached. And there were a lot of tears. But a sense of true understanding and validation that what I was feeling was pretty normal. And so that was a moment leading up to that Mother's Day. On Saturday before Mother's Day, Willie and Isaiah and I went to a birth Mother's Day ceremony that was convened by the same organization that that convened those support groups. And there were 15 or 20 birth mothers there. And the room was arranged with a circle of chairs, and the birth mothers were there. They ranged in age probably from their late teens to late 60s or early 70s. So they were on the inside of the circle, and they were all wearing corsages, as is the sometimes the tradition for mothers on Mother's Day. And there were, on the outside of that circle, there were chairs where the rest of us sat surrounding them. And so those of us in the outer circle, there were some of the children of those birth mothers and the parents who were raising those children There were friends and family members of the birth mothers, and there were people like us who didn't have a personal connection to any one of those birth mothers, but who had a connection to adoption. And so the birth mother ceremony, there were poems read and letters and songs that were relevant to what was going on for those women and for the people who loved them. Lots of tears. At one point in the ceremony, there was a table set up with candles, and each birth mother took her time going up to the table and lighting a candle. And they had a bowl of water with glitter, and so each woman picked up some glitter and sprinkled it in the bowl of water, symbolizing the child that they were remembering. And in one case, a woman sprinkled 5 times into the water, remembering the children that she had lost to the foster care system. So there were a lot of tears at that ceremony. And we were thinking a lot about Laura, even though she wasn't there. So the next day was Mother's Day, and it was a beautiful day. We were living in Cleveland. It was sunny and warm, and we went to church. And the church where we went to in Cleveland had a tradition of first of all, there was a prayer that the congregation said together in honor of mothers. And it was a beautiful prayer that included birth mothers, who so often are not included in those moments of recognition and remembering. We said the prayer together, and then, as is the tradition at this church, all the mothers in the congregation got a rose or a carnation, some flower, and I got my flower for the first time. The church was close to a lake. So after church, Willie and Isaiah and I went out there and took pictures. And later that day, we went to a park in our neighborhood and, had a blanket spread out. And I have this picture of me holding Isaiah, this cute little sun hat on his head. And I was happy that day. I think, we're 7 years along, and those really raw feelings that I felt that first Mother's Day have subsided some, although kind of hard to imagine that the way I feel right now. But those feelings do bubble up at expected and unexpected times when I think about this beautiful boy. And his birth mother, and what she's missed out on. So now on Mother's Day, I think that the complicated feelings that I have more have to do with the complicated feelings that I have about parenting and all of that. But for sure, on Mother's Day, I share that day with Isaiah's first mom and his birth mother, Laura.
All right, let's take those 2 breaths. Just a big in and out, and then an in and out. Thank you, Lorraine.
Yeah, thank you. After hearing Lorraine's story, it's not too hard to get a stronger sense, even a little bit more trust in the power of story, to unite in how we can know each other in a fundamentally different way and understand issues that we thought maybe you already had an attitude about in a completely different way when we actually hear a story of real life from it. But there's influence in stories, but I think the way we apply that influence is a little different.
Yeah, Yeah, when we talk about influence, that sounds kind of like a passive thing, but that's also a really respectful thing. When you can tell your story and be heard, or when you can hear someone else's story and really listen to that, it's kind of the difference between placing limitations and giving intentions.
Yeah, when we tell each other stories and when we listen, we are influencing each other in a soft way. And like I say, you know, it's the action. It's like, I want to take action, I want to do something, or I observe, I listen, and that it's, like Paul says, it sounds passive, but it's respectful, isn't it? We're saying that this person, even though I maybe disagree with them, and I'm sure I know I disagree with them, they're still a person, aren't they? There's a reason why people believe what they believe. It's the reason why they do what they do. Right or wrong is a little bit beside the point. If we want to get touch that, we need to respect them as a person. And so that idea of limitations or intentions is a biggie. And I think when you always try to give limitations, there's coercion, there's control. When we try to create intentions, when you try to work from the inside out, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you have a child, you put that child in a crib, and you're placing limitations around them. And you're making sure that crib is safe and all of that.
Right, they can't do anything wrong in there. Yeah, right, they're safe.
Yeah, you're forcing them to be safe. It's not a choice.
Yeah.
And then you baby-proof the baby's room, and then the house, and then maybe the yard, and then eventually you come to a point where you can't baby-proof things anymore.
Yeah, how do you baby-proof the classroom your kid goes to so that the wrong thing can't happen, or they can't make the wrong, or how do you baby-proof the school bus situation, what's going to happen? You get to a place where you can't control the factors anymore. So this idea of creating this corral out of rules, regulations, authority, power, whatever, to make sure the right things happen to another person, gradually starts to crack. A lot of times, we use whatever power and authority position we have to reinforce it, but it just kind of gets uglier and uglier and more coercive. We all know how that turns out when you turn into a teenager. Anybody here been a teenager? Yeah. Yeah, good job, Mom and Dad. Nice try.
Yeah. You can try and force those walls around someone, or you can try and give them intentions. And that's what we're doing when we're listening to stories and when we're telling stories. We're talking about giving intentions.
Right. So stories influence from the inside out. That's on your center paper. And I think that's an important thing to remember, is that our controlling, our acting, our making sure people agree, our debates, our arguments, our convincing is all from the outside in. The inside out happens when we start transferring those values, and we trust that that is at work in another person and without our control, that they're going to own it and they're going to do what needs to happen. And I think an essential element of trusting those values, trusting that those intentions that you plant within another person, is that they may not decide to do with it what you want them to do with it. And that maybe is okay. Maybe you don't have the answer. Maybe you don't know the right thing to do. Maybe they don't either, but then again, like we were talking about last week, maybe when we all come together and we aren't trying to win or lose, we could actually come up with something that surprises all of us and is better than any of us had ever thought of. And maybe that is how the world really works.
As we were looking at this, there was this passage from Jeremiah that was coming up, Jeremiah 31 through 34. And the gist of it is that there is a different relationship happening. There's kind of the past relationship where limits were placed and where there's these Ten Commandments and you must follow the Ten Commandments. And then there's a new relationship between the people of Israel and God, where God is giving intentions instead. And it says, "The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant they broke, though I was their husband, says the Lord. But this is the covenant I will make within the house of Israel. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No longer shall they teach one another or say to each other, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me."
Right. I think so often we think, well, the Bible is prescriptive. The Bible is that corral. It's keeping telling us what not to do and what we should do from the outside. And yeah, the Bible gets used that way a lot, but if you get to the heart of the Bible, if you get to the heart of God, God says, no, I know those Ten Commandments, you're going to break them. And in fact, literally, the Ten Commandments on stone, they broke, right? So God says, no, I'm going to write this in your heart, and then we're going to have a relationship. You're going to know me, and I'm going to know you, and that's how we're going to co-create this world together. So I think that's a good thing to hold in place. Invite Callie Plago. If you notice on your Sunday paper, the square, Laureen's name is on there a second time. Clerical error, Greg. Laureen, you don't have to do it again. Callie, come on down.
Yeah, let's welcome Callie really quick. And then we'll just do those two breaths again to just center both all of us, but also I know it's helpful when you're speaking. So just to begin, then out, then in, and out. All right, Callie, it's all you.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for sharing your not experience with us today.
Thank you. You know what's hard about going last is I want to respond to everybody's stories, but I can't do that because I have a story to tell. So first, context. 2005 and 6, I was 24 years old. I moved myself to Guatemala, and I was chasing what I believed was God's call on my life to be a missionary, and so I went. Oh, I still believe that, by the way. but so I went to Guatemala. I was really young, and I was there to start a mission. And really, it's funny that you guys were talking about, now this is winging it a little bit, but you guys were talking about listening and acting, and that was really part of my experience, too. Before I was able to take action and be a missionary, I had to listen first, and so I just wanted to affirm that. I spent about 2 years listening and traveling back and forth from Guatemala, from here to Guatemala and back, and living my life here, and then finally I went there. And so the mission is called Céluz. A lot of you, I know, have heard of it before, and actually I've been up here talking about that before, and you've probably seen that. The story's not about the ministry, but I just want to tell you what that was first, because it matters sort of to the story. So what Céluz does is we work with youth in that are Guatemalan. They live there, and they're deemed at risk for being involved in gangs. Street gangs are a big threat to communities in the area where I work and worked. And part of my listening taught me that a good way to approach the problem as a solution is to engage youth in positive, have youth engage positively in their community. So we set up these service projects for them to do. Every month, and a service project would be like, you know, painting a school or a church, or more recently we've been building houses, and it's kind of snowballed as far as intensity. So this one day I went out into the mountains, into this rural area called Chuchuca, which was a suburb or a village outside of a larger town called Patsun. And Patsun and that region is rural. It's in the mountains. It's almost 100% indigenous population. It's just gorgeous. If any of you ever make it to Guatemala someday, maybe with me, let me take you there. It's beautiful. So this one day I was traveling by myself. I was out there in the mountains, driving around, and I was talking to pastors. I was scoping jobs. I was looking for work that we could have our youth do. And you know, I felt really good about how the day had gone. I was on my way home. And there's a town called Patsasia coming home from Patsun. And I just am throwing these names out for fun because I think you might look at a map of Guatemala someday. And so as far as I knew, there's only one road that took me through the town of Patsasia, the main drag. And as I was coming to the highway, the outlet of that into the Pan American Highway, I saw a group of people in the middle of the street, and I saw clearly there was no way that I was going to make it through driving. So I didn't really have a choice. I pulled over to the side of the road, and I was thinking, you know, I didn't know what this group of people was, and I thought it was, in my mind, it was typical, you know, people like are throwing a party in the middle of the street for some reason. Maybe they're celebrating a saint today or some other thing. And so I very, you know, just very innocently, like, got out of my car and approached the crowd, and there was a man standing up the bank from the street a little way, and
I approached him, and I still couldn't see past all the people. And we're talking about like hundreds of people, like a large crowd. I couldn't see what was going on. So I approached this man, and I said, "Hey, what's going on here?" And, you know, chipper, positive attitude. And he answered me, "Well, there's an old man who these four people approached and tried to steal his vehicle, and some people in the town saw it happen, and we're just sick of this. And so the village people just took action and started beating the robbers and with machetes and their fists and whatever they had handy. This is called vigilante justice, if you've ever heard that term. So at that time, there were police officers there. The police officers really are part of the problem in Guatemala. And so in response to that, there were also soldiers from the army present. And the army soldiers are really the ones that kind of keep everything in line, or they're supposed to anyways, because the corruption hasn't at least gotten that far. And so I was stuck thinking, well, what do I do? Am I going to, like, join? Am I going to stand in this crowd and watch this horrific event happen, or will I do something else? And I chose to go back to my car because I didn't really want to see it. So even still, my innocence and my naivete persisted, and I had pop music playing on my radio while I waited this out, and I'm like singing along. And this really intense event is happening so close to me, and I kind of knew it, what was happening. And so I was waiting it out, and all of a sudden I noticed that the crowd started moving in one towards me, walking. And I was like, oh, crap. And so they just kept coming down the street, and within sort of the bunch of people, there was a patrol from the police pickup, and there was no one in the back of the pickup, which would be normal if they apprehended somebody I'd seen before. You know, they stick the people back in the perps in the pickup with handcuffs, and they drive them to jail. But that wasn't happening this time. Instead, there was nobody in the pickup, and behind the pickup followed the crowd, but there was a ring of police officers walking. They made a circle, and inside the circle were four thieves who were bloody. One of them, I don't know if I should say the details if there's any kids in here, but it was really gruesome and grotesque what I saw. And they were walking along in their condition. And at one point, there was a police officer just literally right out my window. I mean, closer to me than you. And so I said to him, "Where are you guys going?" And he said, "We're taking them to the Central Park." And I thought, Central Park, what in the world is going on? And I asked him, "Why are you going there?" And he said, "Well, we're going to burn them." And sorry, I got grotesque and gruesome without. And so I said, "But they're alive." And he didn't say anything more. He just smiled at me. And I saw his gold tooth shining in the sun. And I'll never forget that. And I was really, that was really traumatic for me, being on the outside of things. And, well, anyway, so they continued on. I learned in the news the next day that they did set the men on fire. One of them died in that, and then eventually the crowd had had enough. They were satisfied, and they put the flames out, and they took the other three to jail. But on the way, after everything had passed and I was, continued driving home, I was really shaken, and I had to talk to somebody to debrief. And so the person that I called was my then boyfriend, now husband. He's an immigrant from Mexico. If you don't know him, he's Felix. He's here sometimes, not today. And I told him everything that had happened and wanted him to be like shocked, have a reaction that was as surprised as I was at everything that had happened. And instead he said, "Yeah, so." And that taught me something too. He said two words to me that made me understand his situation so much better. And it wasn't his story that he told me, but it was through my experience and telling it to him and having him react that I felt like I got to know my husband so much better that day. I lost my innocence that day too. And, you know, so many other things had happened that really changed my life and my worldview. So when I first wrote down that I would share a story, I had in my mind that I would tell about a story when I traveled to D.C. to advocate for immigrant rights and, you know, all the stuff that's going on in my life right now. And Greg had said a line to us who had come forward willing to share that to tell our stories from a scar and not from a wound. And the truth is that immigration and politics is a wound right now for me. And I can't, it's not appropriate really to be standing in front of you talking in detail about that yet. Hopefully someday there will be an end to that, that I can finally talk about it. But I tell this story as a metaphor, and also, you know, I want you to know the story, but I also want you to understand that migrants who we celebrate, most of us, I think, that are here in our city and in our country, they come from places where this stuff is normal. And, you know, I tell this story on behalf of people who've come from places like that. So thank you.
Thank you, Callie. Let's just slow down and hold on to that. Take that breath, be comfortable. Live in the fact that you experienced something from Callie's life that doesn't need to be judged or categorized or dismissed or turned into a moral lesson, but it needs to be heard. It needs to be lived with. Breathe in her story. And let your breath that goes out be your thank you. There's too much to be said and really nothing left to be said. The thing is, and you'll find that on your paper, your stories matter. You'll notice it's plural stories. It's not, Callie doesn't have a story. Lorene doesn't have a story. We all have hundreds and hundreds of stories. And every time we discover them and we own them and listen to our own story and we share it with other people and they hear our stories, we become real people. We become less two-dimensional and more three-dimensional to each other. And our world becomes more like that too. We open up ways of not only knowing each other, but of like finding a future together, a future that is better than any of us ever imagined. And I think that is that holy place that God has called us into. So your stories matter. Please learn them for yourself, share them, and give people opportunities to listen to them. We're going to Thanksgiving, you know, and there's a proverbial uncle you've got to deal with and listen to, and he's got to listen to you, but there's also the coworker and the neighbor. There's even the parts of yourself that you don't respect, and you need to listen to the stories from. So let's be the kind of people that do that and to celebrate that.
Thanks for listening. If you found this podcast valuable, please pass it along to others. And we'd love to hear from you, too. You can email us at info@jacobs-well.net or message Jacobs Well Minneapolis on Facebook. We see what we do as a community really making a difference for people. Since you're listening, you probably have, too. If you'd like to make a donation to support this work, you can find ways at jacobs-well.net/give. Thanks. Listen again next week or join us in person Sunday mornings at 10:30.